So I would like to continue to further reflect on this theme of attachment and letting go. And it's something the Buddha spoke a lot about in his teaching, clearly, as it was, as I said earlier, very much at the core of Dharma practice is understanding the mechanism of attachment and the possibility of releasing that attachment and the bondage that it creates. And in exploring what this involves for us, it's useful to have a sense of what it is we get or tend to get caught up in and how that happens. So I'd like to speak some on the one of the teachings the Buddha gave, she described as the four great attachments. And it's kind of interesting as a topic. One thinks, great attachments, you know, like, great, some really good attachments. These are the best ones. Obviously, you wouldn't use such a clear communicating word, but best isn't necessarily the same as great. Great attachments, obviously, really, he means, the ones that are really strong. And actually, everything comes into these four attachments, which I'd like to speak about. Four areas in which we get caught, and which we're asked to understand the process of getting caught in order to be able to release ourselves, in order to free the heart and the mind from the contraction and from the compression, the pressure that is generated when we, through the force of attachment, are attempting to configure our experience or the world or another person in a particular way to make them or it or ourselves manifest according to our particular desire or not according to our particular aversion or dislike. So to reflect upon these. The first great attachment the Buddha spoke of was the attachment to sense pleasure. We like pleasure. And it's really important to get this clear. Buddhism and Dharma teachings aren't saying you're not supposed to like pleasure. It's pretty reliable. We like pleasure. We need to understand that if we grasp hold of that which gives us pleasure, it doesn't give us pleasure. It's very different than rejecting that which may give rise to pleasure out of the fear that we'll get attached to it, which is sometimes what we can do. And it's sometimes appropriate as a way of making some space in order to release the attachment. So in a retreat, we kind of make some space from a lot of the things that might grab us, just so that we can calm down a little bit and begin to see how to release ourselves from them, even in their presence. But we like pleasure, there's no doubt about it. If we put a pile of pieces of chocolate at the end of the row and a pile of lumps of flour and water, and we knew what they were, pretty much everyone would tend to choose the one that they were going to enjoy. Unless for some strange reason, we actually enjoyed something that wasn't very pleasurable. And that would still be pleasure, strangely enough. So what causes pleasure for me or for you may be quite different. But the fact that it is enjoyable is just that. And it can be that the interest in the engagement we have in sense pleasure, in something stimulating, enjoyable, delightful, fun, nice, sweet, tasty, that this comes because at some level we're not feeling satisfied. There's a loss of connection to the source of true satisfaction that is really the underlying malaise of human life, so far as it's not understood. A loss of connection to the source of true satisfaction leads to a seeking and a searching for satisfaction elsewhere when not understood. Leads to a belief, a hope, a desperate prayer that maybe if I get this experience or this pleasure, this nice thing, whatever it might be, that somehow then, satisfaction. It's like the hidden promise is that somehow there is rest if I get enough of this good stuff and get rid of enough of that bad stuff. It's not, we're not doing it just for the pleasure, but the hidden promise is there's an end point that I can rest at where I go, that's enough. Satisfaction. It's like eating food. We eat it thinking, you know, this is great, this is really nice, this is really good. If I eat more of this, I'll get satisfied. And yeah, sure, for a little while. But how long does it last? Probably most of us aren't feeling hungry yet after dinner, after our lovely lunch. But I should think by the end of the afternoon, the prospect of another round of the same starts to look appealing. And that's fine. But how we relate to the experience of something pleasurable is often that I need more of this. I need to keep this. I've got to keep this. Has got to continue happening. Having a nice meditation. Just for a moment, the mind is calm. The body is comfortable. The breath actually has turned up, despite being absent for most of the day. And we think, how lovely. Sort of calm, serene. And I hope this is going to continue. It'd be really good if this kept going. My meditation would be really good. Then I'd be getting somewhere. And then, maybe I should become a monk or a nun. And, you know, we just imagine ourselves glowing with light. And it's like we're somehow projecting the continuance of this pleasurable experience. This moment of comfort, ease. Which is lovely and totally appropriate that sometimes that's what we experience. But we tend to want to continue it. And that's where we put on the pressure. When we start thinking, so how did I do it? Was it because I put my left leg in front of my right instead of the right? Was it because actually just now I'm kind of breathing more like this and not like that? We start figuring out how we got there so we can perpetuate it. And that's the fascination with past and future. In a nutshell, we're trying to figure out how I got here. And if it's good, I want to figure it out so I can repeat it. If it's bad where I ended up, I want to figure it out so I can make sure it never happens again. And then I'm trying to figure out, how do I do that? Of course, I can't. But this movement of trying to secure pleasure, pleasurable experience, doesn't have the effect of securing pleasurable experience. It doesn't do that. And what it does is really rather the opposite and somewhat tragic. Several years ago, I was on retreat at Gaia House, and in the old place in Denbury. So it must have been 12 years ago or more now. And the managers cooked lasagna for lunch. And I love lasagna. It's just like one of my favourite foods. So as I was in the queue, and I was reasonably close to the front having spotted what was going on, I was thinking, lasagna. Great. You know, this is going to be a good day. And I was thinking, but will there be enough for two helpings? Because I knew being at the front, I couldn't really, load my plate up too much because it might run out at the end and then I'd feel really bad if I'd taken too much. But I was thinking, I'll just take a moderate portion. But I was really wondering, will there be enough for seconds? So I took my lasagna to the place, sat down on a bench and was eating it sort of mindfully, not that mindfully, actually not mindfully at all. It was like, will there be enough? Will there be enough? As I was shoveling the stuff into my mouth, I actually really wasn't enjoying it. I was worried about what was going to happen. And when I finished it, and it was actually quite a large portion of lasagna, I was stuffed. There was no way I wanted to eat anymore, and I was kind of like, So my stomach hurt, I didn't want any more lasagna, and I hadn't enjoyed it because I was worrying about whether there'd be more. Is that a familiar experience to anyone? I mean, in this case, it was kind of starkly clear to me what was happening. And even in the midst of it, I sort of had a little bit of an idea that's what was happening, but not quite enough to let go. And the tragedy is I did not enjoy the lasagna. Not that I couldn't eat any more. And that sense of how there's this promise that we're seeking for that's always somewhere else in the future. This is the trap that we need to see with the pleasant experience. To be able to let it go. We look for entertainment everywhere. We're constantly looking for entertainment. I mean, I don't expect, I mean, I'm actually rather surprised how much people actually do what I suggest when it comes to giving instructions and meditation guidelines and that. But nonetheless, it's always interesting to see, having suggested, probably you don't need to do too much reading or writing on the meditation day, that some at lunchtime there's this table full of interesting reading material. It's about the Dharma, most of it. It's kind of, and it's like, oh, let's have something to read. It's fine, there's nothing bad about it. But see how our minds go looking for entertainment. It's not okay just to sit here. We've actually just had a nice meal. Nobody's doing anything nasty to us. Got a cup of tea. But it's like, feed me, feed me, feed me, feed me. And it goes on and on and on. And if there isn't any literature on the table, people start reading tea bags. You know, the label on the tea bag. And it looks like it must be really fascinating, the amount of mindful attention being given to it. That sense of, I want, I need, I must have. This is kind of powerful, and it's important not to... It's important that we don't somehow think, oh, I've seen through that, Dharma teachings are clear, I see the wisdom, I should just stop doing this. It really takes quite some time and practice to begin to release this fixation. And there's I find a helpful, in this context, story from that I heard when I was in America some time ago, of a conference that His Holiness the Dalai Lama attended, and he himself told the story in the conference, where he said for this whole week he was staying in a hotel and he was driving to the conference every day, being driven in fact by someone, and as he was being driven through, I think, the streets of New York, it happened to go through this area where all the electrical goods shops were. And His Holiness, if you know him or anything of him, he's kind of interested, and perhaps even you could say fascinated, with technological gadgetry. And in quite a sweet and sort of noy childlike way. And he described this experience of every day being driven down the street and looking in the windows of all these shops. And he said, my eyes got wider and wider and wider. And by the end of the week, he said, you know, I desperately wanted all those things. And I didn't know what they were. So again, we can recognize ourselves. It's like, that must be it. That's what's going to make me happy. I don't know what it is, but it looks good. And you can feel almost the body language of it. It's like, give me, give me. Beginning to look at that process, to see that it doesn't actually produce what it promises. Not because I or anyone else said it's not a good idea, but look and see, does it produce what it promises? If it does, great, go for it. But if it worked, most people would have got there by now, given how hard we've been working on it, would have been able to relax. Mostly that's not what we find. So, to not invest in experience, in pleasure, in gaining the pleasurable experience as the source of satisfaction, doesn't mean that we shouldn't experience it, or that we wouldn't benefit from understanding how to meet it, in fact. So it's not to reject pleasure, it's not to say... And sometimes the message seems to come out of certain interpretations of the Dharma teachings that somehow pleasure is bad. Pleasure is just pleasure. Attachment causes suffering. It's not even bad, it just causes suffering. And to learn how to meet that which is sweet or beautiful is important, because it's a source of immense nourishment and uplift. It's important to be able to enjoy that mouthful of lasagna that you have, even if it's the only one you've got. And so what does this involve? It really involves understanding that trying to grasp, attaching to it, asks of it something it can't give, and actually takes away what it can offer. William Blake understood this when he wrote the words, the poem, "He who binds himself to a joy does the winged life destroy. He who kisses the joy as it flies lives on in eternity's sunrise." It's all there, really. when we bind ourselves to that which gives joy, it destroys the aliveness of it, the winged life, the lightness, the ability to fly, to move, to flow. It kind of locks the situation up. Our grasping locks the flow of life up. And we lose what it had to offer. But to kiss it as it flies, to be able to make contact with it, simple, sensitive, intimate contact, that suggests. But as it moves, knowing that this thing moves, that it flies, is just now here, and in the next moment gone, is to live, in Blake's word, in eternity's sunrise, in the dawn of the timeless. So to be open to the touch of that which is beautiful, or simply enjoyable, because it speaks to something in our heart, but to know that in and of itself, it's not the end of the matter. And at the same time, to equally understand as well that just as no thing is the solution, equally no experience is the problem. And that when we experience the unpleasant or the difficult, and really, again, we don't like the unpleasant. We don't like what is painful to us. Buddha Dharma is not telling you have to like what is painful. This would be a recipe for struggle and disaster, I think. But we need to see that it is part of our experience and accept that that is so. Because again, it's the resistance and the struggle with the unpleasant that creates suffering in that context. Not the fact that something is unpleasant or painful or difficult in and of itself. There is something painful in that, or difficult, sure. My knee hurts, my back aches, or my mind is feeling fractured, fragmented and frazzled. That's uncomfortable. But to be able to meet the experience as it is, in that context, letting go means letting it be as it is and letting go of our wish that it should leave and questioning the view that we hold that so long as this is here, I cannot find peace or rest. That peace or rest will only come when this experience has gone. My chattering mind, my aching knee, that guy at the front who keeps talking, whatever it might be. When this is gone, then I can find rest. That's the trap. That's the illusion, or the delusion, in fact. And how much time we spend trying to get it comfortable and right. Get a posture that never aches or tingles or hurts. There isn't one, sorry. At least not one that lasts forever. To get the temperature right, it's a little hot, a little cold, blanket on, blanket off, more jacket, less jacket, scarf, hat, sunshine. I want the sun on my face, but I don't want to get cold with the wind. How do I do that? If I face this way, maybe. We can spend all our time trying to adjust. And in doing so, we've given in or we've subscribed to a falsity that says this is where it actually ends. This is the solution. Or that says this is the problem. That the problem is these experiences that are difficult. We all experience difficulty, pain and challenge in various ways. Accepting that that is so, and that that is not actually the heart of the problem, enables us to look more deeply into experience, to connect more fully, and to no longer be driven by the fantasy that through reorganizing experience, happiness will somehow come and last forever, or that peace will be born out of manipulation and control. The second great attachment that the Buddha spoke about was the attachment to rites and rituals. The idea that if we just perform this particular action, somehow then we'll be saved. Liberated or admitted to heaven or whatever it might be. And in the Buddha's time, there was a lot of rather, we could say, more obviously superficial ritual behavior that was very much engaged in by various traditions. And probably, I suspect, most of us here today and in the West would think, oh, I don't have too much of a problem with, you know, rites and rituals. No, I'm not really into those. And I certainly probably wouldn't turn up here if you were, because there's not much of it on offer. You know, some people like a sense of, well, you just do this and you just do that. And then, you know, believe in this, don't do that, and everything's okay. But interestingly, I think the attachment to rites and rituals goes deeper than most of us might imagine. Because where there isn't an obvious external one to hook into, or even if we think we have an aversion to the whole idea of rites and rituals as being not really making much sense to our sort of well-developed Western intellects, nonetheless we create them. We create them in all sorts of ways. And I would suggest to understand this attachment more usefully is to frame it as the idea that something outside of me is going to do it for me. The belief that somehow liberation, salvation, transformation is going to be done to me or from outside of me if I just conform with whatever the criteria are. If I just walk mindfully back and forth and sit quietly on a cushion, then somehow something's going to do it for me. Now, there's a certain truth in this, but only if understood correctly. Because we need to be engaged. The attachment to rites and rituals, when it operates, means we start to disengage from the process. We're no longer fully in what we're doing because we believe that somehow the form of it is what does whatever it is that's supposed to be done. Does that, you follow that? It's like we're giving the authority to the form when the form is just a form. And so in our tradition, I suspect, the kind of rituals most of us we'll get a little attached to is, for instance, how long we should sit. 45 minutes. It's kind of like the right amount, isn't it? You know, 30 minutes is okay, but isn't 45 minutes? Well, that's what they do on all the retreats, you know. But then we know about those crazy fanatics over there who sit for an hour and a half. They obviously, you know, we hear about some other tradition where they do it differently. We think, it's a bit dubious. But those people who only sit for 20 minutes, well, you know, it's a bit lightweight, really. Of course, we might start, you know, we might say 20 minutes is the right amount and 10 minutes is lightweight and an hour is obviously evidence of some sort of fanaticism. But we create those kind of pictures, or we make something out of slow walking. Slow walking is a wonderful practice. I love it. And yet I've noticed that, I'm sure other people have noticed at times, if someone walks quickly through a bunch of people doing slow walking, you're kind of like, what are they doing? You're not supposed to do that. We're doing mindful walking. That didn't look mindful. That didn't feel mindful. We don't know whether it was mindful. We've got an attachment to the idea that slow walking is what you do. And attachment to rites and rituals tends to show itself by a critical or angry reaction to something that doesn't fit the mold. Likewise, silence. Now, I really ask and hope that everyone will respect the silence when we're practicing together. It's really supportive. And yet, for some reason, sometimes people need to speak because maybe they're new and don't understand, or maybe there's some urgent practical thing happening, or maybe right in that moment they just can't quite hold the intensity and there's just some unconscious mechanism that releases the pressure by engaging through speech. And while recognizing, oh yeah, we want to hold this container and support everyone in this way, if we're starting to think they're bad, or that's, you know, somehow condemned somebody to, you know, sort of rebirth in a hell realm, we've missed it. We've lost the plot a little. It's like we've come attached to the silence. And in this, I'm saying nothing to take anything away from the value and the power of the silence and really dedicating oneself to it. But what other people do with it is their practice and their business. And if we're getting attached, it may be useful. Maybe their speaking or the noise of someone's deep breathing or snoring if they've fallen asleep, there's something to help us wake up to where we're getting caught. And it also shows itself in the sense of trying to get it right. It's kind of interesting, rites and rituals. Rites are when you do it right. You know, rituals, by their nature, you have to do them the correct way. If you use your left hand instead of your right hand, it goes horribly wrong. I don't know if you've tried shaking hands, you use this hand. It gets really messy. People don't know what to do. They do in the scouts, I think, don't they? When it doesn't work like that, it's like we want everybody to conform with our belief in how it should be done right, because it kind of makes us feel safe. And in terms of one's own experience, if you notice yourself trying to figure out how the exactly right way to do it is, it's partly, I suspect it's going to be partly because of the view that if and when I've got it exactly right, then it's going to work. Then it's going to happen. And this, again, can be kind of unconscious. And it's always useful with these things to take it with some humour when you can see yourself, and as I see myself doing this. But one thing I've noticed over the years, and I know the more I speak about it, probably the less likely it is to happen, but nonetheless, it's not that it's important that it happens. But when I teach a retreat, if I always put my hands here on my knees, 2 or 3 days into the retreat, the vast proportion of people have put their hands there. If I put them always here, people end up putting their hands there. Because they probably think, I assume, that somehow the way I'm doing it is the right way. So I mostly try and alternate. Because I don't want to perpetuate that illusion that I know the right way in terms of where to put your hands. They have different forms have different effects, clearly. But in that, it's more like, I'm not really trying to point out that thing, how we relate to it, but more the sense of getting it right. If I get it right, then it will work. It's not working because I didn't put my hands in the right place, or it is working because I did. That kind of thinking is rites and rituals, attachment to. And as I said, the effect of it is it's like we disconnect. We somehow, and I kind of first understood this reflectively for myself when I was doing walking meditation. I realized I was doing it meticulously. If you'd looked at my practice, it would have looked so good. But some part of me wasn't there anymore. Because I decided, oh, you just do this. And in a strange way, as long as you're mindful, you can be absent. And, you know, if you develop it, you can be mindful and absent at the same time. Takes practice. And I spotted that was what was happening. And it was just like something else just needed to be alive in there. So this is, it's a little hard to say it accurately, because whichever way I say it is a little bit wrong. But nothing and no one can ever do this for you. Nothing outside of you can do this to you. Nor can you do this for yourself. Okay, so it looks like a little bit of a problem. And the midpoint in that, because actually it's just another rite and ritual attachment, the idea that I'm going to do it. Because that I becomes something outside of what you truly are when you create it in that way. The I that's going to do it is actually not capable of it. But nor is anything out there. As soon as we do that, there's a way in which the vitality of our life, of our engagement, disengages. And the loss of that is critical. Because without that, the whole thing isn't alive. It starts to become an empty shell, a facsimile of what otherwise would be transformative. And this is something which happens in greater, it's probably never completely so that we're completely absent or completely, you know, present in that way, in that aspect. It's like, but to a certain degree, the more we're able to be engaged without trying to make it happen through that engagement. Can we do that? Can we rest in that place, which isn't somewhere we can point to, where we're engaged totally with this form of being mindful and present, so far as you can. Totally engaged, and yet not trying to make it happen. The mind has trouble getting that. But the heart knows what that is. That deeper dimension of our being knows what that is. Because that's how it works. As far as I've seen it anyway. Kabir says, Are you looking for me? I am in the next seat. My shoulder is against yours. You will not find me in the stupas, nor the shrines, rooms, nor synagogues, nor in cathedrals, nor meditation halls for that matter, my words, nor in masses, nor curtains, not in legs winding around your neck, nor in eating nothing but vegetables. When you really look for me, you will see me instantly. You will find me in the tiniest house of time. Kabir says, student, tell me what is God. Tell me what is truth. He is the breath inside the breath. Nowhere else. So can we stay that immediate with what we're doing here? What we're doing in our lives? Putting the responsibility not somewhere else, nor creating the belief that somehow I have to do it. It's like responsibility without, or accountability without claiming to be in control, because we're not. And then that vitality is engaged skillfully. And through that vitality and that engagement, transformation comes. So the third great attachment that the Buddha spoke about is the attachment to rights, sorry, to views and opinions. Almost got a rerun there. Attachment to views and opinions. And the Buddha spoke of this as a fetter, as a thicket, as a place in which we get lost, basically, like a jungle or a pathless wilderness where we get lost. In our belief that we know the way things are, we limit our sense of being able to discover what is not yet known by us. So far as we have certainty, we are constrained by it or held by it and unable to move beyond the perspective that it offers, that the certainty is linked to. And we can see how we have attachment to views and opinions. You know, we believe we know what's right. Now, this is a little different than understanding the appropriateness of wholesome action and of refraining from harmful action, which the Buddha really clearly distinguished as not an issue of views and opinions. That it's not saying that, oh, there's no such thing as a valid view or perspective on life. And clearly a valid view is that to refrain from causing harm is crucial, so far as we're able to refrain from doing so. And likewise to understand that being of service to the well-being of others, this is beneficial, this is crucial to understand. But the views about exactly what's the right way to do it, for instance, that we might have, that's something else. And about everything else, from the origin of the universe to the right meditative technique, we can have views about them, about what's right. And that sense of what's rightness, of rightness, creates a sense of security. In the face of a world in which experiences come and go and are inherently unstable and unreliable, in the face of a world where nothing can save us, nothing out there is going to do it for us, we tend to look and to be drawn and pulled very strongly towards something that we can create that's secure. And because views and opinions we create, with some help from outside, but we create in our own minds, we can make them solid as we like. And that's great, because then they don't have to change. And finally, there's something that doesn't change. So long as they don't question it, it's going to stay like that. And it feels safe. When you question people's closely held beliefs, they get scared and they get angry. When someone questions our or my closely held views and beliefs, if we're not open to that, it's scary and it's threatening. That's attachment to views and opinions. And we do it because it gives a sense of security and the illusion that we can thereby protect ourselves and advance our welfare and well-being. We don't do it because we're bad or stupid, because we think it serves to be that clear and absolute. But it limits us. It limits the way in which we can engage with life. And we see that information is power in our world. When you know information, when you have information, it gives you power, if it's right. And so our sense of being right is connected with a sense of being empowered. Someone actually came in here and said, we know definitively meditation's a waste of time. This has been proved. Everyone agrees out there. You know, in here we'd probably start thinking, oh, come on, well, you know, kind of we'd be deflated a bit, I guess, if we were forced to believe that right now. I don't at all. I guess you could imagine. But if someone takes something away that we're holding to, it's scary and we don't want it to happen. But it creates possibility. And this is what's powerful about investigating this area of attachment. It opens up vast potentiality. And it's possible for us. Nyanaponika Thera, in his book, The Heart of Buddhist Meditation, who's a venerable Buddhist monk originating from Germany, who lived in Sri Lanka and died in his mid-90s, I think it was, and end of the last decade. He wrote, "True wisdom is always young and always near to the grasp of an open heart, an open mind, that has painfully reached its heights and earned its right to hear it." Like, true wisdom is something that's fresh, it's young, it's not old, it can't be old. Once insight becomes a concept, it stops being alive. Even that which is true in one sense loses its truth when we grasp it in our mind. If we're not living it. True wisdom is young, it's fresh, it's alive. It has the character of being both new and yet strangely familiar. It's always, you can tell wisdom when you meet it because it's both fresh and familiar at the same time. And what is it for our mind to be an open mind, an open heart, to painfully reach its heights and earn its right to hear it? We have to be willing to enter the territory of uncertainty, to release our attachment to the apparent safety, but the limiting and binding effect of certainties. Voltaire once said, "Doubt is indeed an uncomfortable condition, but certainty is ridiculous." What is certain? To face uncertainty is to face our life and our death simultaneously. And I had an interesting experience of that. A few years ago I was teaching, or I was about to teach a retreat in Wat Buddha Dhamma, a monastery in New South Wales, Australia, and it's set in the Darra National Park in the rainforest and jungle. I'm not sure it's quite rainforest, anyway, it's jungle. And I arrived there for the first time and was shown to my kuti somewhere out the back of this rather vast area of the monastery. And decided in the afternoon to try and shake off the jet lag that I would go for a run. And so I went running up into the hills behind the kuti I was in. And at some point as I was running along the path, I saw what looked like a rise and a sort of like a little hill. It looked like it was going to have a wonderful view. And I was in the middle of all the trees and that. I thought, I'll just climb up there and have a look at the view. So I climbed up. I left the path and just walked up through the trees, and I'm quite familiar in the sort of the bush and the wilderness in that way, so I was quite happy to do that. And just walked up about 10 minutes to the crest of the ridge and looked over, and yeah, quite a nice view, yeah, okay, good. And turned around and went back down to the path. And after about 15 minutes of heading down, I thought, I thought it was about 10 minutes up. And another 5 minutes down, I thought, damn, I've missed the path. So I turned around and went up the hill again. And I didn't see any sign of the path. Got up to the top. Thought, oh, gosh, what happened? So I just thought about, okay, what was I doing? Where was I? I was facing like this. And, yeah. Paid careful attention. I'd oriented myself, you know, when I climbed up that hill. And I went down there. And I went back down. 15 minutes, 20 minutes. Maybe it was further up than I thought. I'll just keep going down. It's got to be down here. Went down for 30 minutes. No sign of the path. Turned around, went up. Starting to get dark. I was wearing a singlet, you know, a vest and running shorts. And I've been blundering through this jungle. I did that 3 more times before it was dark. At which point I thought, oh no, I really can't find the path. I'm sure it's down there, but I can't find it. So I started actually pulling up some branches and leaves and starting to make a little bit of a sort of a something to lie on, realizing, well, I'm probably not going to freeze to death. It's like February in Australia, but on the other hand, there's snakes and there's scorpions and there's spiders, and it's kind of a bit scary actually as the lights were going up. You know, the sky was darkening, and I realized I could no longer see. So I thought, well, I can't make any more attempts. I'll, you know, fall over. It was really quite steep country. I'll fall over and injure myself if I do any more. So I started making this place to rest. And then I started to reflect, well, what's happening here? I know the path down there. Why can't I find it? I've been down there 5 times. Why can't I find that path? And then this thought broke into my mind and it said, the path isn't down there. You don't know where you are. And this flood of fear, terror, just poured through me. It was like visceral, existential, And in that moment, my mind, in a millisecond, flickered through, you could be facing 180 degrees the wrong way. You've got completely disoriented. Maybe at the center isn't there, maybe it's there, or maybe it's there. You've got no idea, you're lost, you're absolutely shot, you're going to die on this hill. They won't even know you're gone till the opening talk is supposed to happen and you're not there. And it just, you know, in a microsecond, it just went, and it was like, oh, yeah, that's true, but if it's not down there, and this is what next happened, if it's not down there, because I thought it was, I was sure it was down there, but it's not, maybe it's down there. Until that moment of fear, I could not contemplate that it was somewhere else than where I thought it had to be. So I thought, okay, I'm sure it's down there, it's not, I'll just go 45 degrees to my left and go down there. I went down there, 10 minutes later, found the path, got home, it was close to midnight. I was covered in scratches and soot because there'd been a fire up there. I must have looked like quite a sight. Fortunately, no one saw me, and the retreat was starting the next day. So I was fine. But very important lesson, because I could not, until I admitted that I did not know where the path was, allow myself to look somewhere else. And that's what we do when we are attached to our view of how it must be. We will only look where we think it must be, the solution, the answer, or the possibility. And to be willing to go through that place of I do not know, because by definition, that for which we are looking, we do not know where it is. And if we want to live in the safety of I know already, we won't find it. We won't find it because it's not actually so far away. But if we're not looking, we won't find it. And kind of remarkable other piece of the story was that at the end of the retreat, I was still trying to figure out how on earth did I do that. So I went back up there, I went for a walk. And I looked up at this thing and I thought, okay, this time I'm going to figure out what happened. So I went up and I was so careful. I was marking in my mind every tree, every outbreak. I had the sun fixed at that, you know, that angle from my torso as I climbed. I knew exactly where it was going to be as it went down. I went up to the top. I looked around. I thought, yeah, that's what I did. I came here and somehow I got confused. Went back down. I knew where the path was. It wasn't there. And I thought, you absolutely, you know. But I thought, okay. So I went back up. And I thought, something's happened here that I just cannot comprehend. But what I know is that it's not where I think it is. It's got to be around here. I went down and found it. Although everything was saying to me, it's not going to be down here. And what I realized as I went down the second time and just watched what was happening, when I came down the first time, it was dark. And when I found the path, I hadn't seen what had happened. And it was like there was a very gentle curve on the ridge. As I climbed it, this isn't really anything to do with the teaching, but it's a good story. As I'd climbed it, the ridge had been curving in a way that I couldn't perceive. Yeah. And though I was sure I knew where I was facing, by the time I got to the top, I'd moved about 45 degrees off. And all my certainty had been the biggest obstacle to getting off. Because anyone else up there who hadn't really paid any attention would think, I think it's down there, go on back up. I said, well, it's not down there, I'll try down here. But not me. So, are we willing to go, to enter into that territory of uncertainty? Because within it is immense possibility. Certainty circumscribes potentiality. It's comfortable, but in the end it's not worth it. Well, that's 3 out of 4, and I've pretty much used the time I had in mind to speak for. So I'll just say a little bit about the fourth great attachment. It's one that I suspect many of you are quite familiar with. The attachment, well, familiar with the teaching, and probably familiar with the experience. The fourth great attachment that the Buddha spoke of is the attachment to the sense of self. The belief in, and the clinging onto the sense of being somehow a separate, isolated individual, discrete from and removed and apart from everything else. The idea that we are that, and that there is somehow some fixed of ourselves that makes us feel comfortable. Trying to turn up or show up or make ourselves into that which we think will resolve our problems. And in doing so, we treat our life as if it's something for us to manipulate or to own or to control when it's not. And how much time we spent trying to become better than we are. To be good, believing somehow that we're not. To be enlightened, believing that somehow that is something that we could gain, as if we could ever lose what that actually is. How much time we spent doing that? See how much your mind is involved in this process of trying to become someone or be something, and how painful that is. When we're sitting in meditation and we start thinking, looking around, everyone else can do it, but I can't. And we feel, oh. Or we look around and think, well, I'm doing really well. They're all falling asleep. The same thing is going on. We're somehow investing in a sense of me that isn't real, isn't true, in the way that we conceive it to be. And really, this is a whole topic in itself. So, in terms of the practice of looking at this, to look and see for yourself when you're struggling with experience, or when you're pursuing experience, when you're getting caught in attachment and it's grasping or aversive expressions, look and see how it is that the sense of who you believe yourself to be, or would like to be able to believe yourself to be, is involved. Because mostly what's the deeper pain in something that we don't like is that it gives us a self-image of someone we don't like. So if I'm experiencing myself with a mind that's filled with judgment, I don't like the judgment because it somehow compels me to believe that I am a judging person, and that doesn't seem like very nice. Or if I'm struggling with the pain in my knee and my mind's reacting to it, a lot of why we don't want the experience is because I don't want to be someone whose mind is like that. Or we're getting attached, where we want to be someone who feels calm and peaceful. Not just because calm and peaceful is pleasant, but because the idea that I am someone who's calm and peaceful is actually deeply beguiling to us and attractive and flattering. So to learn to let go in this is simply to see that, oh, this is what's happening. There is anger, not I am angry. It means to take responsibility for the experience, but not to define yourself by it. Because no experience defines you. They come and go, they pass, they change. When they're there, they need attention and care and wisdom, clearly. And likewise, not to define you as not that. Oh, that's anger, has nothing to do with me, and I blame my parents. That doesn't work either. If you locate yourself within or outside of anything, this is dukkha, this is suffering, and this is a manifestation of attachment to the sense of self. The need to locate yourself or a sense of self as being this, whatever this might be, or as being not this, i.e. nothing to do with me. Whatever way that expresses itself creates a sense of a location and a solidification that is somehow separated and removed from everything else. So long as we invest in that process, if we don't understand it, we are isolated and cut off. Our experience, our conscious experience, becomes isolated and cut off. Ultimately, in understanding what is true, we see that we are not and never have been or could be isolated and cut off, because that whole separation is an illusion, but one that we enforce and reinforce and invest in because it creates a sense of security and safety. And so this willingness to let go, the whole teaching of Dharma comes down in the end to understanding that holding creates a dimension of suffering that is optional in the end, and that letting go is the mechanism of release that comes not because I think it's a good idea, because I've been told I should, but because we've seen the suffering in the holding and that it doesn't serve us the way we imagine it does. And then we let go. It's like that. It's not even we that let go. Life lets go. Letting go happens unstoppably from that wisdom, from that understanding. And letting go, then we see, it's not some kind of deprivation that we may think of it as, but it's an act of compassion. It's the natural response of our being to life when we see how things are. And it's not a rejection of what we've renounced, but a choice born because we've recognized what's beneficial. That's what wisdom is. It teaches us, it shows us what serves. When we act on wisdom, it leads to the reduction or the ending of suffering. And the wisdom that sees that holding amplifies suffering and that letting go reduces and ultimately releases it. This is Dharma practice in a nutshell. And when we let go, when we really let go, when we're willing to be unlocated and unlocatable, when we're not creating anything solid, in the releasing of that familiar and secure and yet incredibly limited and bound and tangled sense of locatedness, what's more true than this shines through. And we actually can see directly and know immediately, unmediated, with nothing in between. The knowing and what is known is the same. Because there's no separateness, there's no separation. And this is the heart that is unbound. The awakened mind and heart that rests nowhere, cannot be found, and yet cannot be escaped either. So let's just sit quietly for a minute or two. May we all, through our practice and in our lives, be released from the bondage of attachment. And may we, for ourselves, discover, and in ourselves, discover the truth that is luminous, peaceful, radiant and unbound. For our own welfare and for that of all beings.